From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Closed school buildings mean many North Carolina families are getting their first taste of online education. They'll get some helpful hints from the head of a public online charter school. State lawmakers continue to have concerns about the state transportation department's spending habits. You'll learn why. If the COVID-19 pandemic has you longing for the days when non-lethal political scandal dominated the headlines, we'll give you a brief break from the health woes by focusing on lessons from Watergate. Plus, we'll learn how all of the disruption in our lives today is affecting marquee election matchups in North Carolina, the matchups for governor and U.S. Senate. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Going to work, flying on an airplane, eating in a restaurant, hosting a birthday party, attending a church service in person. Just some of the things that many of us have not been able to do with our family and our friends for several weeks now due to government prohibitions while we deal with the spread of COVID-19. So when we emerge, what will we have learned and how should our recovery look? Amy Cook is the CEO for the John Locke Foundation. She joins me now to talk about a look ahead as we move ourselves out of this unprecedented situation. Amy, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Donna. Thanks so much for having me.
We have heard the president talk a lot about looking ahead. And here in North Carolina, we are waiting, at least as of the time you and I are talking, for Governor Roy Cooper to make some statements about what will the future look like and how will we roll out this reopening of North Carolina.
That is so true, Donna. The state budget director has come out and said, I know this won't shock anyone, that if we aren't already in a recession, we're headed towards one, as if that's something we couldn't all feel. But I think for those of us, you know, every day seems the same now.
As someone told me, March has lasted forever.
Yeah, right. You're right. However long we're into this, and at least the earliest we would look at reopening the North Carolina economy to on any level is April 30th. You would think that if we're looking ahead to April 30th, that our governor would have at least something in his mind about how we phase in reopening. And Carolina Journal actually asked the governor that question, and it's a legitimate question. I think it's a question we all have. We're talking about it right here, right now. How do we reopen? We're looking at it, if it is April 30th, we don't know. But if it is April 30th, which is the way it stands right now as we are talking about it, it's a few weeks away, but there has to be some kind of a plan. And we asked, or Carolina Journal asked that of the governor, and it wasn't that he said, listen, I'll have something, or he didn't say, you know what, I'm not ready to make that public, or we're having those conversations, they're in the early stages. He simply didn't respond at all. And it's been, I think, it's been probably almost a week since that question has been posed to him, and Carolina Journal followed up, and then asked, listen, did you even get the email? This is a legitimate question to ask of the chief executive of our state.
Well, it's on everyone's mind.
Right.
My impression, Amy, is that people are more than willing to do their part to try to stop the spread of this. It's serious. We haven't seen something like this before. But we also are seeing people that starting more and more to talk about it, in the case of Carolina Journal, to ask important questions about where is the balance and what is the end game? At least what is the measure by which we will say, okay, this metric, we've now reached it, and therefore stage one of recovery begins.
Right. When can we start phasing in certain you know, certain businesses. And I think, and at what point, what is the tripwire? Like you said, what's the tripwire? When have we flattened the curve enough to where we can start talking about being safe at work rather than shutting down a business? So here's how you can be safe while working. We don't have to shut you down. It was interesting. The mayor of Chicago got a haircut. Literally,
how? And can I have access to that person?
One of the hot spots of the country. And her point was, I'm the face of our city. There's truth in that. But the person who cut my hair wore a mask and gloves. Okay.
Makes
if
sense.
That, great. We all agree. If that will keep the mayor, the chief executive of Chicago, safe, can't the rest of us start doing that very same thing, too? She was being safe while getting a service. I mean, we can do this. But again, what is that tripwire? And when do we start seeing the flattening of the curve? Coming out with those and these models, Donna, they're all over the place. So part of it is, you know, what is a tripwire? Well, which model are you going to follow? Are you going to follow the one that has tens of thousands of people dying? Are you going to follow the one that says, you know what? I think when you practice safe social distancing, when you're wearing a mask and when you're wearing gloves or you're doing all the things you need to be safe, can we flatten that curve and keep and reopen the economy? We cannot continue like this for too much longer.
You know, I had a conversation by text, not in person, conversation by text with someone who is a small business person, and it's a one-person operation, and he was asking me, well, I guess I need to look into this whole federal action, and will I be one where I can actually get a lifeline to try to keep my business open because he can't do anything? He's considered non-essential. And I said, you know, you need to check out the rules and all that. And so after we texted about that, he then texted, you know, even if I'm eligible for the federal lifeline money, as he put it, that's not what I want. I just want to go back to work.
I just want to work. There's also, it isn't just the financial aspect of it. It's also just sort of the, you know, it's like the almost mental health aspect of getting out of your house and going to work. There is that, you know, confidence that comes from working, earning a living, putting food on the table for your children. I was listening to the Wall Street Journal. They have a podcast every morning. I was listening to that, and they're talking about possibly putting more money into that SBA, that lifeline, because much of it's already gone, and there are people that tried to get it that couldn't.
So Paycheck Protection Program.
Right. Mm-hmm. Couldn't get it. And so now they're making hard choices on, do we lay people off? I mean, we're at a very critical phase right now. Chief executives have to come out one way or the other and let folks know. Are we going to start phasing in opening? Can we reopen and practice safe social distancing and being safe? I think we can. We're Americans. We can do a whole lot of things. One of them is getting back to work and doing it safely, because we're all concerned about our health and our families and everything.
Absolutely. And as we await more information from Governor Roy Cooper as to what his administration's plan might be to open up North Carolina again. We know, Amy, based on the research done by analysts here at the John Locke Foundation, that we're better off than most states when it comes to opening the doors back up and being able to handle what could turn out to be critical needs in the meantime, because we've got roughly $3 billion cushion here. Not that we want to spend all that now, but if we have to, we can.
Right. We do have money. One of the things that we're going to have to watch out for, and it's not just North Carolina, it's a whole bunch of states, but it's that delay in tax revenue.
Yeah.
So getting
time impact.
Right. And getting through to June 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year. Will we have to do something to backfill that? And then it's not available for next year. I think you're going to see North Carolina, thanks to the excellent leadership at the state capitol and our state legislature, they budgeted wisely, they budgeted prudently, and that's why we have some cushion. And yes, we are in a better position than many other states. Still, we're going to have to look at the budget carefully.
Amy Cook is the CEO of the John Locke Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic has shut down North Carolina schools. It's forced parents to learn about online education. During a recent John Locke Foundation event conducted online, an expert offered parents ideas about how to deal with education conducted through a computer. Lauren Akam is head of school at the North Carolina Virtual Academy, an online charter school. She discussed adjusting students' schedules to an online environment.
We need to create a schedule that works for your family. Allow students to work at their pace. Allow them to take breaks and to move throughout the day. Don't expect that they are going to sit from 8:30 to 3:30 like we sometimes picture for traditional schools, but really create a schedule that works well for your family. And in doing so, I think it's important to designate some sort of workspace for your student. So a place where they can go and it's theirs, that they will do school from that spot in the house. It's also important that you set realistic and attainable goals, both daily goals and weekly goals, so that your student has something that they are working towards. But also be patient with the process. This is new for many families. I'm trying to juggle it myself with three kids now at home and working full time, and my husband, who is an administrator at a traditional district. We're trying to figure out what works best for our family. And so we're providing for flexibility. We're giving each other a lot of grace as we move through the learning curve. But we're also continuing to stay engaged and consistent with what our children are supposed to be doing on a daily basis. So ask questions, make sure that you know what it is that your student should be accomplishing each day, and ask them to show you their work. So be really involved in the learning process during this time.
Teachers who have never conducted classes online are now learning about virtual education. That impresses Akam.
It has been amazing to watch teachers across the state in traditional brick and mortar, in charter schools, in online environments, really come together to do what's best for students during this time. And DPI has been great about providing resources and hosting trainings. We've had quite a few teachers at NCVA who have held trainings for other brick and mortar teachers as to how to maneuver the transition. I've had a principal host a professional development about what it's like to lead in the virtual environment. And so really just continuing to lean on each other, I think, is critical. Putting differences aside and knowing that we are all in this for the best interests of our kiddos across the state.
Akam offered some ideas for ensuring that online education is working for children.
Communication is key. We communicate frequently, openly, and honestly with our learning coaches. Those are our parents and family members who support our students. So if a parent has the instinct that the student is struggling, I would say reach out. you cannot over communicate in a time like this. And also phone calls. I think we can't dismiss the value of picking up the phone and calling families. You know, it's easy to hide behind a computer or an email, but there's a lot more power that comes from connecting via the phone. And so parents know what's best. They can tell if their child is struggling. And if that's the case, do not be afraid to contact the teacher and just tell them what you are noticing and ask for ways to support the student.
The COVID-19 pandemic is revealing some facts about education in North Carolina.
One thing that this is proving is that we do need alternative settings to school. And we do need to think outside the box. We need to be creative and innovative with the way that we view education. And I hope that at the end of this, it's going to lead to larger discussions, larger conversations between educational leaders across the state, government leaders, as to what our education system looks like. You know, we're in a crisis right now, and we know this isn't going to be the last crisis. We're going to have hurricanes. We're going to have something else that hits, and schools should not have to stop. We should be able to continue to provide a rigorous quality instruction for our students during these times. And so I think it's going to lead to greater conversations as what does that look like and how can we come together to provide that for our students.
That's Lauren Akam, head of school at the North Carolina Virtual Academy. She spoke recently for the John Locke Foundation about the challenges and opportunities linked to online learning. Akam's own school has remained open throughout the pandemic. It hasn't expanded. State law caps its size.
We just need to prove that there is the need and that we can be successful in educating and growing our students before we expand to the rate of being able to allow every student who wants to come in. And you know, we are not looking, and we know that this is not an alternative for every student. I mean, it's only works for some. It's not going to replace a traditional school or traditional school district. But there are many families who do seek this kind of learning environment.
Akam explains why a transition to online education involves some challenges.
When you try something new, there's always a learning curve with it. And so for some, they will come to us and maybe realize, okay, it's more work on behalf of the parent or the learning coach than what they had originally thought, or it's not just a self-paced program. You know, we do have class time and live instruction. But I would say more and more we're finding parents who come to us absolutely love it and say that it has changed their students' view of school. Many who have come to us have had some sort of traumatic experience in a brick and mortar, and we're kind of able to reignite their passion for learning. And so that's why we do what we do, is because we do have more cases of students, and we see success stories for students who have not been successful in a traditional brick and mortar. So it drives us to do the hard work day in and day out.
What's the school day like in online learning?
It's a more personalized school day. Students are able to, we focus really on mastery-based learning. So students are able to demonstrate mastery of standards before moving on to the next learning objective. So it's much more individualized, much more personalized. And we're able to do that because we do maintain a pretty small class size student-teacher ratio. All of ours are 20-1. So really, teachers are able to work directly with students in the classes.
What's the future for online education in North Carolina? Akam expects policymakers to discuss that question.
We will have those kind of larger conversations at the end of all of this. And I think funding, you know, will be a large piece of that. I know that when we talk about funding, there's generally a pretty strong political divide. And I think, or I hope what we'll see is that we can put politics aside and we can do what's best for kids. Because ultimately, I don't care, you know, who the teacher is or what kind of environment they're working in. that's their goal, is to do what's best for kids. And so we need to look at a funding structure that sets all schools up for success, not just some, not just schools in districts with a wealthier student population, but we really need to find a solution that will set all of our students up for success across the state.
That's Lauren Akam, head of school at the North Carolina Virtual Academy. She took part in a recent online event sponsored by the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The North Carolina Department of Transportation has come under fire because of overspending. DOT officials recently told lawmakers about efforts to fix the problem, but State Representative Dana Bumgardner has continuing concerns.
Well, it sounds like that DOT's got some serious issues here, and maybe y'all have closed the barn door after the horse is out. If we're slowing down or stopping maintenance, are we saving money on maintenance now, and in the future it's going to be more expensive to fix? This didn't happen overnight. That's been a long time coming, and how are we going to move forward?
State Senator Tom McInnes also raised concerns.
It appears, based on everything we've seen, we got a mess, and the mess is also appears not getting any better. I've got contractors calling me that can't pay their employees.
DOT has delayed some spending. That raised a question for State Senator Rick Gunn.
Would it be safe to say that maybe we're actually in worse financial condition than maybe this presentation has led us to believe? Should we as a legislative body be anticipating DOT coming coming back with their hands out for some pretty significant additional appropriations. And this is a black eye. I'm getting it in my district, and it's hard for all of us. It's embarrassing for us, but we are where we are.
Amid criticism, DOT has defenders. Republican Representative John Torbett took aim at some colleagues.
Does DOT come back and with their hands out asking for cash? I don't ever know that they've been hands out, because what they do is for the people of North Carolina, so it's to better the network of transportation for the people of North Carolina, not for DOT. There are remedies to that. For example, when over $600 million is going to nothing but litigation-led payments, not to roads or bridges or rail or ports or ferries, $600 that's going to litigation relative to a court settlement. And when you have $300 that's coming out of the coffers of DOT for hurricane relief, when you have a rainy day fund sitting over here in another bank account that could provide that temporarily until it's federally reimbursed to be paid back, then that's money that's not going to the people of North Carolina's bridges, roads, rails, ports, airports, all of that. So there is a solution to that, though, however. Instead of coming back with their handout, perhaps we need to get a list of projects that are in each person's area and have us go back home and decide with the people back home that made the decisions on those projects which ones to delay or which ones to remove in an effort to bring our overall spend rate down. So then we never have to worry about being over or under. And we just go back to the days before we began leadership and go back to the 400 projects a year instead of maybe 1,200 projects a year.
That's State Representative John Torbett defending the North Carolina Transportation Department. Multiple colleagues had questioned its spending habits. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. He has served as North Carolina's Attorney General and its Secretary of State. He took part in one of the roughest campaigns for governor in North Carolina history, and he played a role in exposing the Watergate scandal. I can only be talking about Rufus Edmiston, and he discusses all of these topics and more in a new book. It's called That's Rufus, a memoir of Tar Heel politics, Watergate, and public life, and he joins us now to share part of the story.
Hello,
welcome
Mitch.
To the program.
Yeah, 1984 was a bad year. That wasn't a good year to run in as a Democrat.
No, tough year. There are many things we could talk about, but since our time is limited, let's focus on one item that is actually in the subtitle of the book, Watergate.
Yes.
Remind us, how did you get involved in all of this mess of Watergate?
Mitch, I was a staff member with Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina from Morganton, and I always told him when I was growing up in Boone, I want to work for you someday, and so I kept pestering him to death until he allowed me to work for him. I worked on his Constitutional Rights Subcommittee and his Separation of Powers Subcommittee, and then along came this thing called Watergate, and I was thrust in the middle of it, and I was telling somebody that I was too young to have the responsibility I had. You, at 31 years old, you don't know anything at all much. But that is when I went to serve the subpoena on Richard Nixon. It was the first time in history that a subpoena had been served on a president by a committee of the Congress. And, of course, I was not unaware that it was a very high-loaded charge day when I went down to the White House that day. And I didn't have an entourage, but I had a phalanx of news people, because they were very anxious about this, because it was the first link that we knew when Mr. Nixon became involved in Watergate, because of the revelation of the Butterfield Watergate tapes. And that is where it started, with the Senator Ervin and Baker, who worked like a team of horses together, by the way. That's one of the lessons of Watergate. They actually worked together, unlike today. We don't have fortifications. We don't have silos. We didn't have those like we do today. And they were a fantastic team together. And Mr. Nixon, not unlike so many other presidents, he let it get the best of him. He let that old disease called hubris get him, and thought that the president could do anything he wanted to do under Article 2 of the Constitution. And it didn't work. And Watergate, though, was a good example of how when you work together, things will work. And that we've been unfolding of the working together ever since Watergate. We thought that would cure a lot of things. It didn't. Watergate's come up on us day and night. And so much of it, Mitch, is occasioned by the huge amounts of money occasioned, in my opinion, by the decision Citizens United. And so Watergate is something that I would say that all administrations should look and study Watergate so they won't repeat all those mistakes. But it seems as though that's being repeated as we speak today.
You mentioned that you were working at the time for Senator Sam Ervin, who longtime North Carolinians will definitely know the name, and people following politics today know his grandson is on our state Supreme Court,
yes.
Sam Ervin IV. People at the time could have said, oh, this is just Democrats in Congress trying to get our Republican president. What did Senator Sam Ervin do? And you mentioned him working with Senator Baker to make sure this wasn't just some partisan issue, but this was really dealing with a real problem.
He and Senator Baker made a deal in the very beginning. We will not disagree on things. Never was there a vote where there was a dissenting vote on the delivery of the subpoena or any witnesses. And also, he was very careful to have a staff that was not dogmatic. We were told time after time after time, go where the facts are and don't go off into partisan hijinks. And I'm afraid that we do that now, both on the Capitol Hill and both in the executive branch. People are off on their own. Watergate also had a public aspect to it. As time went on, the public saw that things weren't just right when you had a president who the tapes reveal said, okay, let's how much would it cost to pay him off? That's a pretty good sign that something's going on real badly. That would get you 17 years in jail today. And so it was a different era, a different time, a kind of comity between the parties. And actually, most people think that Richard Nixon was impeached and convicted. He was not, of course, as you well know. He left because a group of senators, Republicans, came down from Capitol Hill, Senator Barry Goldwater, Senator Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, and others, and said, Mr. President, if you don't resign, they will impeach you. And if they impeach you, you will get convicted, and some of us will vote for conviction. So it was a different time. We were not so fortified on each side and so venomous. And it's a totally different. A lot of the common elements run through Watergate and the goings on today. But I will admit it's purely partisan today on both sides.
We are not going to have a chance to get into all of your future public life, but in serving as Attorney General, Secretary of State, running for governor, what are some of the lessons you took from Watergate for the rest of your political career?
That sunshine is the best of all things. And I messed up one time in my career and didn't follow the lessons I'd learned in Watergate. And hubris is such a disastrous disease that when you get puffed up and blown up on your own worth, you think you're better than everybody else and nobody's going to ever catch you at anything. I, one time in my career as Secretary of State, didn't follow those good lessons. But I've learned that if you have the public awareness of things, that it is not so bad as it can be when you try to do government in secrecy. Secrecy is the enemy of the people. The press is not the enemy of the people. Secrecy is the enemy of the people. And that's the one big thing about Watergate. We put it all out there, and I used to say that Sam Ervin was the teacher in chief in America of constitutional law.
all of these events took place 45 years ago or more. Are you surprised that Watergate is still as much a part of the public consciousness as it is today?
Not at all. Every time you turn around, there's a new gate attached to some kind of a wrongdoing or some kind of a sketchy subject. It is not, because it was the first time that the America took part, really, in a great debate. Now, you had the McCarthy hearings, but very few people at that time had a television. And this was this. I remember, Mitch, we were getting as many as 40,000 letters a week. Now, I mean letters. I don't mean emails. I mean letters, handwritten out, and postcards, and telegrams. The public was involved in it, and it obviously at the time you had only three channels plus public television. And now, my goodness, you're so jumbled up that people's attention is focused on one of 1,400 different channels, and one, and with 24-hour news cycle, we don't know what's going on. It's so jumbled up.
In our few remaining moments, the lessons of Watergate, we've talked about them, the need for transparency, the need to be bipartisan. Do you think we're going to get to a political situation where we don't have gates in the future, or are we always going to have kind of gate?
The way it's set up right now with some of my friends, I'm not condemning them, but you know them like I do. The political consultants are going to make sure that we don't get together because they won't have as much business. Everybody now looks for their 5-second soundbite, and it's got to be tangy, critical. And it's personal most of the time, and we don't need that.
If you would like to get more than sound bites and much more about the political history of Rufus Edmiston, you'll have to read the book. It is titled That's Rufus, a memoir of Tar Heel politics, Watergate, and public life. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The spread of COVID-19 has affected virtually every aspect of our lives, potentially even the 2020 election. Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Cal Cunningham hopes to take away the Senate seat now held by Republican Tom Tillis. And in an op-ed published in the Raleigh News and Observer, Cunningham makes the case for his vision, as we learn from the coronavirus. Now, Carolina Journal is following this Senate race very closely and the COVID-19 epidemic. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins us now to talk about the potential impact on the election. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
In this op-ed by Cal Cunningham, he writes that the crisis requires additional federal action and that we must ensure rural communities have high-speed broadband. Federal action for that, Rick?
That's something that, of course, progressives want to see happen. They would love to see the federal government take over the broadband infrastructure entirely and nationalize the end. They would have some sort of nationalization of the industry would not be beyond their request, so that they can guarantee that everybody gets it, or that if it's not nationalized, at least so that everyone gets subsidies and gets it for free. Now, there are subsidy programs already in place, so that's sort of beside the point right now for people who are low income, that sort of thing. They already can get that for free. The question is more access. This is something the General Assembly here in North Carolina has debated quite frequently and has come up with some ways to expand the access. But as Carolina Journal has been reporting now for more than 10 years, problem when you get the government involved directly in building the infrastructure for broadband is that quite often by the time that the government gets around to constructing something, the technology is outdated before it's even deployed. This is a very fast-moving industry. And so the idea of perhaps instead doing something like food stamps, giving people a subsidy to purchase internet service from a provider, is a better way to go if you're going to provide income or if you're going to provide access to people who don't have it right now. Let them go out in the marketplace and bid for it, and then the providers will come along. The 5G technology that's rolling out is largely wireless. It's kind of like cell towers, if you will, in some ways. You don't need to dig ditches and go through rights of way and, you know, cause great disruptions to lay fiber and cable. You're just doing it straight through wireless signals. And so, I mean, that's sort of the way to go. Cunningham is sort of talking about this right now without really specifying, does he mean, you know, laying 1 gig fiber through the middle of the forest, or does he mean 5G? And basically, once the feds get involved, who knows what that would involve?
I think you've laid out the policy implications and the different options really appropriately. Yet I also thought, Rick, that it was really smart politics for Cal Cunningham to write about this now and get it published in a major North Carolina newspaper, because obviously we now have school kids who are now receiving education online. So the question of broadband access and equality, and I use that word in quotes, is now front and center from every parent. Well, smart politics.
Well, one of the issues, too, and this is where the government got in the way, if you will, is that by closing schools and by closing libraries, the state has actually cut off access to who knows how many students who got their broadband access from their school or from their library. And so this is the sort of situation in which the government's, you know, created a problem. Now it's trying to solve a problem it created. So that's not the kind of problem solving you'd like to see.
Right.
The other thing is that you do have some school systems that I've been reading about in some of the rural counties that are actually figuring out ways, asking parents to drive their children to the parking lot of the school so that it may be within range of the school's broadband network. And that way they can get some of their materials at least. They might not have their classroom instruction done that way, but at least if there are materials they need to download, they can do that. So, I mean, people are trying to figure out ways to make this work, but it sounds to me as if Cal Cunningham has more of a one-size-fits-all solution in mind, and that usually is problematic.
Now, meantime, Cunningham's competitor is the Republican incumbent in the U.S. Senate, Tom Tillis. He's been doing some tele-town halls, some phone things. What do you think about that strategy?
This shows the example of how incumbency can be a real benefit if an elected official is involved during time of crisis, that the person who actually has the ability to pull some levers and to make some things happen, if that person is accessible and if that person is willing to go out and talk to people and explain what's going on, then this is a great opportunity to use the so-called bully pulpit. And Senator Tillis is doing that. He's been doing this almost daily, I think, for television outlets. I think he's done it for different associations and groups like that, and they've all been open. They've been either on Facebook or on some other platform that's publicly accessible, so it's not as if he's just broadcasting it to a specific audience necessarily. So this is all things that an incumbent senator, an incumbent elected official of any sort should do during times of crisis, is to be out there to answer questions, to either reassure people or tell them how long it's going to be before something's likely to happen, and he's taking advantage of it.
Well, speaking of leadership and talking to your constituents, we have seen that nearly daily over the past several weeks from Governor Roy Cooper, who, of course, wants to be reelected for another term. And, Rick, we've seen a poll or two that show that North Carolinians like the job that he's doing leading the state during the COVID-19 crisis. So is this something that he can essentially, in political terms, ride into a second term?
It could help him. It really could. I mean, we're also seeing the approval ratings for President Trump rise during this time, because typically speaking, people look to the executive to provide information, comfort, some sort of idea of roadmaps and things like that. And the governor has been doing news conferences pretty much every other day at least twice a week and sometimes three times a week at these emergency management center. His Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mandy Cohen, has been there daily along with the emergency manager, Mike Sprayberry. So, I mean, they've all been available there. And it's the sort of thing that definitely you can ride to an advantage. Now, the question is in delivery. You know, how well is he going to do? It's a long time between now and November. So if he is seen to be someone who is responding, as if his administration is getting things moving again, if they're being responsible in the way they're handling the eventual reopening of things, if he's not being arbitrary in how he's enforcing laws. I mean, if all these sorts of things play together, then yes, it's going to be very good for him. If there are major hiccups or glitches along the way, then it could be worse because, again, the focus is going to be on him because he's the person in charge.
What does this mean for his Republican challenger, Dan Forrest? Haven't seen a whole lot or heard a whole lot from the current lieutenant governor the past couple of weeks.
Right. And this is a challenge for the challenger. He's going to have some tough times breaking through. Now, if there are slip-ups that don't directly appear as if he's trying to gain partisan advantage by pointing out the slip-ups, then there are opportunities for the lieutenant governor to say, look, this is something I could do better. This is something I would do better. This wouldn't happen on my watch.
And potentially that gets us into the questions about how will we recover out of this and what will the Cooper administration's plan be for opening up North Carolina. Carolina Journal has been asking questions of the governor, and as of the point that you and I are talking, Rick, we haven't gotten answers, or you haven't gotten answers from Governor Cooper about his plan once we get through this to allow the state to recover.
That's right. We've asked specific questions about what are the metrics they're looking at, what are the goals they're looking for, what does reopening look like, how soon will we know, what sort of advice is he taking, and we're not getting any kind of answers at all.
You can read it all at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.